unknown islands, towards the green darkness of swamp and rainforest, presented to him the worst fears he could imagine. Valentine Ross was a man who was fond of order. His dedication to doctoring was born of his idea that the physician's primary task was to identify the nature of a patient's disorder and to do whatever he could to restore the body and mind to harmony. To travel to a region of the world where the climate alone seemed designed to make man ill, where trees crowded the sky, where ants could swarm from the forest floor into every space occupied by humankind, where leeches could burrow into the body's veins and arteries, was a task so completely beyond his capabilities that he now wondered how it could ever have entered his mind. As the capercaillie wandered away into the pines, leaving Ross with the feeling of being absolutely alone, with nothing else stirring in the field, he was invaded by an intense dismay at his own shortcomings. Jane Adine, his adored white angel, had looked down at him from her great height and found him wanting. He had searched for but could not find the courage to travel vast oceans in the hope of saving his brother's life. What in the world was to become of such a flawed and cowardly man? Chapter 6. Raja. In Borneo, things were no longer quite as Valentine Ross believed them to be. Edmund Ross, recovering slowly from malaria, was not lying in the kind of fearful hovel so vividly imagined by his brother, but had been brought to the grand, high-portaled house of a self-styled Raja of the South Sudong territories, Sir Ralph Savage. Here, the young man rested on clean linen sheets. On Sir Ralph's orders, Chinese servants brought Edmund sweet water from a garden well, bowls of sticky rice, and a potion made of bitter Jesuit's bark and molasses, upon which he himself swore as a preventative against death from malaria. Edmund slept a fevered sleep. From time to time, Sir Ralph would come into his room and look at him. Pale from his sickness, his long-fingered hands resting on his chest, his dirty hair matted, as though to resemble thorns, Edmund Ross reminded Sir Ralph of nobody so much as Jesus Christ himself, and this strange likeness brought into the Raja's heart complicated feelings of wonder and yearning. He longed for Edmund to wake up for long enough, not just to sip the bark potion, but to begin to talk to him. There were many Rajas in Borneo at this time. All had their hearts set to the ticking of the European clock and acted as rulers over the native peoples. Malays, Arabs, Milanos, Dayaks, Bugis, and a small contingent of hard-working Chinese. One of them had even waged a deadly war in 1863 on behalf of one Malay tribe against another, seemingly only to assert his power to command bloodshed and sacrifice, as if that was the one thing he yearned for. But the Rajas differed wildly in their treatment of those who labored in their fiefdoms. Most were incompetent, demonstrated an unnecessary cruelty born of fear, and often, to their own surprise, could detect no improvements in the quality of human existence which surrounded them, not understanding that if they had treated their workers with greater consideration, they could have begun to make things better in this singular part of the world. Sir Ralph Savage, however, despite the terror that seemed to be written in his name, was not quite of this lazy and unthinking kind. He saw that Rajas and Sultans could, if they chose, bring happiness and prosperity to those they claimed to rule over, provided they refrained from levying harsh taxes on the Malays and had the imagination to see where that happiness might lie. Sir Ralph was a man who adored being alive, who found beauty in things which others did not necessarily see, and who, despite his overwhelming appetites, believed that Jesus Christ would watch over him and bring him by some means to everlasting salvation if he could only do some good in the world. Brought up in India, he had then been sent by his wealthy father to Oxford, where he read divinity. He had liked his studies, but had stayed in Oxford for only 1 year before deciding that the darkness of England was killing him by slow degrees. He returned to the subcontinent and joined the Honourable East India Company's army, from which he was dragooned out of after 7 months for repeated and unacceptable acts of gross indecency. Unrepentant, his heart still raging with unformed ambition, he fitted out a fine schooner and sailed southeastwards towards the Indian Ocean in search of adventure, power, sexual nirvana, and the opportunity to practice philanthropy. With the death of his father, he was now in possession of a baronetcy and a colossal fortune, which he believed could help obtain for him a kingdom in the wild, romantic East. To come by this kingdom, he approached the Sultan of Brunei, who claimed distant rule over the whole peninsula. It was known that the Sultan gave out gifts of territory in return for favors, and so Ralph presented himself as a man who would do anything that was asked of him. This, however, was not entirely true. He believed in the Sixth Commandment. He did not like killing people. When the Sultan ordered him to help put down a local insurrection by Lan Dayak, he felt himself falter. But his dreams of his own fiefdom were stubborn. He could not envisage any other way of being happy than by waking each morning to look out on his own portion of the world. And so he contrived to gather round himself a group of Malays addicted to cockfighting and pay them to leave aside their cruel sport long enough to subdue the head-hunting insurrectionists and to lay before the Sultan a basket of Dayak heads. Sir Ralph's financing of this bloodthirsty episode haunted him for a long while, but the Sultan was pleased to be rid of the Dayaks. He kept the basket of heads strung up in a grove of Mediterranean pines and was interested to record at what terrible pace the flesh became mushy and melted from the bone. This slaughter of his enemies, together with sexual favors tailored to his imaginative needs, impressed the Sultan sufficiently for him to bequeath to Sir Ralph a substantial parcel of land in Sarawak irrigated by the Sudong River. Now, the Raja designed a palatial house not far from Kuching, using both Malay and Chinese laborers, whom he paid with minute grains of silver. He saw it rise, astonishingly white, like an iceberg towering up from the ocean waves, against the impenetrable green of the tropical forest. He chose to see it as a thing of beauty, a temple of civilization in a chaotic world. He planted the gardens with scarlet canna lilies, orchids, banana trees, bamboo groves and coconut and date palms, set round with manicured English lawns. He built an aviary and sent the local Malays out into the forest to snare cassowaries, toucans, chestnut-hooded thrushes and umbrella birds whose exotic cries and jeweled plumage reassured him that life here in Sarawak was designed to capture all that was extraordinary under God's heaven. In spite of his extravagant desires, Sir Ralph Savage had little of meanness in him, and as soon as he'd installed himself under his colossal roof, with his favorite Malay servant Leon as his primary bed companion, he set himself upon his path of philanthropy. In Leon, Sir Ralph had chosen a remarkable man, someone who knew far more about Borneo's yearnings and dreams than the English Raja could ever understand. In hot nights, holding Leon in his arms, he kept asking him, "What is to be done here, Leon? How am I to improve upon what the Creator has given us?" He told his lover that he wished to go down in history as one who had enabled happiness. Leon advised him to begin by building a road.
"The road to where?" Sir Ralph had asked.
"Sir Ralph," said Leon, "there is no where in Sarawak. There is only nature. Men begin, nature finishes."
"Then what is the point of the road?"
"The point for the road is to try to be." Sir Ralph stroked Leon's thick, oily hair. Because he liked this answer and didn't want to argue with his lover, and because he was infatuated with Leon and wished to deny him nothing within reason, he began to design plans for his road straight away. He announced that it would be called the Savage Road. A cruel quantity of stones had to be found, broken and crushed to form its base core. This stone, hewn from the hilly ground by Chinese laborers, gave it impressive stability. And when Sir Ralph showed this proudly to Leon, Leon said, "White and strong, Raja, sir, just like you in the British Empire," and exploded with irrepressible laughter. Sir Ralph didn't mind being teased by Leon, but when the Chinese road crew informed him that nothing else could be found for its surface but tamped earth and ground sandstone, he understood straight away that when the heavy rains fell, the Savage Road would appear to send tributaries of itself slithering away into the forest. And this dismayed him. He wished to feel proud of his road. His appetite for the great tasks in life was boundless, but he suffered when what he had seen in his mind was blighted by some unexpected flaw. After each drenching rain, he would walk out along the road past the new settlements that he was building on either side of it, past Malay children playing in the mud, past the little stockade where cockfighting took place by firelight and moonlight, and note how much earth had been washed away. He cut a strange figure, dressed in a crumpled linen robe with his greying hair tied back in a silk ribbon and wearing leather boots purloined from East India Company army stores, standing in the middle of Savage Road and cursing the sky. The little Malay children laughed at him. The Malay women hid their laughter behind soft shawls, but
Saraf didn't care if people found him funny or ridiculous. He only hoped they didn't find him cruel. He himself had endured enough of cruelty from his peers in the army of the East India Company to wish for a world where it didn't exist. Sometimes he'd kneel in the mud and pray to his beloved Jesus to send rain in more modest quantities, to help him return the lost earth to its rightful place on what he sometimes called his providential highway. But the rain in Sarawak was relentless. Another thing troubled him. Lian had warned him that the savage road would have no proper destination. It merely ran to the limit of the land over which Saraf claimed to rule and then stopped. And this he had to accept. But where it stopped, the forest once again reared straight up in its terrible darkness, and this made him feel slightly breathless with dread. Saraf could hear and observe the forest's intent, seeds cascading from branches to embed themselves in the earth, lianas groping towards the ground, roots sending out tentacles into the crushed stones, the wind in the high canopy blowing everything towards the road's end, where the shadow of the trees already moved over it in a restless tide. When he lamented to Lian that the jungle was his enemy, he was surprised when Lian replied, "No, Saraf, my friend. Don't be a nincompoop. This jungle is the cradle of all things." After many days of sipping the bitter tree bark medicine and forcing down a few spoonfuls of rice, Edmund Ross was strong enough to be led to a tin bath and bathed in warm water by two Malay boys. His nostrils filled with the scent of carbolic soap, his wild, spiky hair was washed and tenderly combed. He began to take in his opulent surroundings. Ebony furniture made in China, fresh muslin curtains at the window, Indian rugs, jade statues, overstuffed brocade armchairs, gold candelabra which would not have looked out of place in Queen Victoria's dining room. Sensing these things, or rather the person who had gathered them around him, had saved his life, Edmund felt a sudden, profound gratitude towards him and was overcome by a fit of weeping. His attendants withdrew silently, leaving Edmund alone in the bath, racked with sobs. Trying to master himself by examining his legs and noting their shrunken state, as though they might have been the trembling white shanks of an old man, he was then surprised by a voice very near him, which asked in aristocratic English tones, "Shall I assume that you know how to read?" A towel had been placed on the rim of the bath, and Edmund now reached out for this and dried his eyes. Seated beside him on a lacquered stool was Saraf Savage. Edmund at once recalled that he'd seen this person once or twice before, standing by his sickbed and regarding him with tender concern. Now the man reached out and laid a caressing hand on Edmund's damp hair. "I ask," he said, "because this is the one thing lacking from my life, someone who can read to me in faultless English, preferably from the New Testament. Is that something you would be prepared to do?" "Yes," said Edmund. "Oh," said Saraf, "well, that is very, very consoling to me. You cannot know how much I long to hear these verses again, spoken with feeling. There are missionaries in Sarawak, but their voices are too loud and their hearts are too hard. They shun me and I shun them. I am a lover of young men. These people affect to despise me for this and inform me that I am damned in the eyes of Jesus. But they are wrong. I have many times spoken to Jesus, and I know that he understands me, because of his own great love for St. John. And I judge that you will not despise me. I have been told you are a butterfly catcher. Your mind must therefore be open and attentive to all that exists under the sun." Edmund now looked closely at Sir Ralph. He saw an ageless face, tanned and lined a little by the sun of the tropics, with thick hair falling to his shoulders and eyes of a startling blue, reminding him of his brother Valentine. His lips were narrow but sensual. From one ear dangled an exquisite piece of carved ivory, this ornamentation alone giving him the air of a pirate. The thought thus passed through Edmund Ross's mind that the man might be holding him captive in his eccentric mansion. But if this frightened him for a moment, he also knew that he was too weak to put up any resistance to his captivity. And he was alive. He was alive when only a few weeks ago he'd been near to death in a fragile hut roofed with leaves. Whatever was going to happen to him here, he would have to surrender to it. The evening of that day found Saraf Savage and Edmund Ross, now dressed in clean clothes too large for his emaciated frame, sitting on the veranda eating catfish and sweet potatoes and sipping arak, while all around them, hundreds of fireflies came out and glowed in the darkness. In the shadows not far from them crouched Leon. Seraph appeared to pay him no heed, and the crouching figure was so still, so soundless, that Edmund almost forgot that he was there at all. But after some time, Seraph turned to him and asked him to bring an oil lamp to the table, and Leon got to his feet and went quietly into the house. While he was gone, Seraph said,
"I pay Leon with small pieces of silver. If he stays with me, he will be rich one day. The only condition is that he must be available to me day and night. He is very clever and lovable, and has the silkiest arse in Borneo. I hope I do not shock you by saying this."
"No," said Edmund. Seraph tipped back his glass of arrack and drank it down.
"Men must speak of these things," he went on. "We must speak of all that our souls long to confess. We must speak of everything in the world and speak of it truthfully. That is my philosophy. Well, perhaps you will tell me yours."
Edmund smiled, but it was too dark on the veranda for Seraph to see the smile.
"I was born in Wiltshire," said Edmund. "I was raised to be obedient and silent, and to keep my body in a like condition, with the expectation that I would someday become a minister of the church. But when I was quite a young boy, I discovered the world of the insects and the flowers, and that always felt to me like a small patch of paradise."
"If you discovered paradise in Wiltshire, why did you come here?"
"Because I wanted to test myself, to see whether I could survive in an unfamiliar world. I have tried to follow in the footsteps of Mr. Wallace. My quest is to send back rarities to England to make men marvel."
"Very good," said Sir Ralph. "I got the impression that the English are a little starved of marvels, and I believe that if there is nothing of the marvelous in our lives, we begin to die."
Chapter 7. A Portrait. It was one of Emily Nadine's favourite pastimes to hire a strong horse and go riding on the sandy highway of Rotten Row and Hyde Park.
Although this was a popular place among London society to see and be seen, and many people liked to ride in companionable groups, talking as they went, greeting other riders, showing off their equestrian skill no less than their a la mode riding habits, right down to their exquisite calfskin gloves. Emily preferred to ride alone. She wasn't particularly concerned to be seen. What she liked was the thrill of the ride. Always urging her mount to a fast gallop, she crashed her way round the row at chaotic speed, almost in the manner of a riderless horse who stubbornly keeps ahead of all other contenders in a race. Just the sound of the horse's hooves pounding the earth excited her. And as for the speed, she had frequently declared to her friends that she knew nothing in the world more exhilarating than this. Impatient with the slow groups of riders who might impede her path, Emmeline often appeared at the stables near dawn to take her horse on its wild ride round an empty track. Then what she loved was to see the sun coming up over the eastern edge of the city, to feel an answering rise of colour in her own cheeks, and to feel that, despite her years of lost children, despite her abandonment by Jocelyn Hulton, her life was still delivering something of wonder, something of grace. With Jane now installed at Tite Street, Emmeline soon enough announced to her niece that riding would be part of their lives, and Jane had agreed. She joked that only a very tall horse, at least 16 hands, would have to be procured for her. "Otherwise my boots will trail in the sand." And Emmeline sent her maid Nancy round to the stables with this instruction. On a cold autumn morning, Emmeline and Jane set off for their first ride. Jane's horse, named Nero, was large and frisky and inclined to pull too hard at the bit in its impatience to gallop. But Jane, like her aunt, was a courageous rider and enjoyed her mastery of the animal, encouraging it at moments to slow to a stately walk so that she and Emmeline could admire the burning colours of the leaves flying in the wind, the icing of frost on the grass. It was during one of these walking moments that two riders, a man and a young woman, mounted on chestnut horses, overtook Jane and Emmeline at an elegant trot. Once past them, the gentleman rider turned in the saddle and stared at Emmeline, and Emmeline stared back, and her mouth opened, as if to utter a sudden cry. It closed again as the gentleman turned away and, with a word to his female companion, urged his horse into a canter. Jane saw that her aunt kept staring until the couple were out of sight. Then Emmeline said quietly,
"That was Jocelyn Hulton, with his latest mistress. I should not care a fig for it, for he's an old man now, but seeing him has made me feel very dizzy and hot. I'm terribly afraid, Jane, that I'm going to faint.
Jane tugged Nero to a stop and quickly dismounted. She took hold of the reins of Emmeline's horse and helped her down. Leading the two horses with one hand and letting Emmeline lean against her as they walked towards the frosty grass, Jane led her aunt to an iron bench set out under an ash tree. Here, Emmeline sat down and leaned forward, putting her head close to her knees. Afraid to let go of the horses in case they bolted, Jane could only stand close to her aunt and will her to recover. Nero threw his head up, jangling his bit, unhappy with the sudden stillness of everything, but Jane held tight to the reins.
"I'm sorry," Emmeline whispered. "I'm sorry, Jane."
"No need for sorrow," said Jane. "Only the sorrow you feel. And how could you know when this would come upon you, even though the years pass? In my work at the baths, I observe this all the time. The shock, perhaps long delayed, which suddenly arrives in the mind and lays the body low."
That evening, after Emmeline had rested and recovered and drunk tea by the fire, she said to Jane,
"I have always seen goodness in you, dearest Jane, but it is tempered by something else, something harsher and more determined. I don't know what that harsh thing is precisely, but I know how to find out. I would like to paint your portrait."
"Oh," said Jane, "you want to paint me in order to find out who I am?"
"I know who I think you are," said Emmeline. "But now I feel that I do not know you right to your core."
"And supposing in my core I turn out to be somebody very wicked?"
"Well, that would be interesting. Then you might have to be restrained by some means, I suppose, but not by me, because I know that restraint is never to your liking, and I love you far too much to hurt you. Might we begin the portrait tomorrow?"
Jane wished to be standing for the painting. She said to her aunt, "I don't think you will see me correctly unless you depict my height." Emmeline regarded Jane closely for a long time. As always, when she began a picture, some words of Jocelyn Halton's echoed in her mind.
"For your female sitters, call upon myth," he had said. "Think of Greek goddesses, for women like to feel immortal. You must make them look as though they will be worshipped for all time."
It came to Emmeline that there was already something of the immortal in Jane, and that all she had to do now was capture it. She asked Jane to put on a white gown, as similar as possible to those she wore at the baths, and position her in front of one of those tall windows which gave onto the small neglected garden of the narrow house. The visible portion of the sky was blank and pale, and at once Emmeline could see how the tones of this picture might help suggest the immortal essence of Jane Adeane. A study of differing shades of white sky, a lace of white frost on the briar patch, white face and hands and neck, white cotton fabric, all suggesting an affinity with a condition of previously unblemished whiteness. But what would make it strong and real would be the discoloration upon that very whiteness, showing how time and texture and season cast shadows on all things and rendered them unique and grave, but yet suggesting here the stoicism of the sitter in the face of time and decay. As Emmeline set up a tall canvas on her easel, she already felt excitement about the picture. She was impatient to sketch in the rough outlines with charcoal and begin working with her beloved oils. But one thing about the composition wasn't yet right. Jane's long-fingered hands hung loosely at her sides, inert and slack, and Emmeline knew that this detracted from her goddess-like status, making her look idle and somehow at a loss. She broke off from her preparations, rummaged in the low cupboard where the failed artifacts she'd made on the pottery wheel were stowed away in a clutter, like a collection of damaged toys cast aside by a child. At the back of the cupboard was the wooden box in which she kept the golem. She lifted this out, opened it, and took up the little mannequin. She stared at it for a moment. Then she crossed the room and put it carefully into Jane's hands. Jane looked down at what she'd been given. She felt moved that this was what Emmeline wanted. For Jane to be the custodian of a thing, or should she call it a creature, which had been important to her. "I already feel tender towards it," said Jane, "and in your portrait you will give it new life." Emmeline reached out and touched the soft skin of Jane's cheek.
"Let me remind you," she said, "that it is you I am searching for."
The portrait was begun in the flat grey light of a winter London morning. After a long while of standing obediently still, Watching her aunt's gaze make small movements between her canvas and her subject, Jane's mind began to be preoccupied with something she had never before seen so clearly. That Emmalina Dean had survived sorrow and tragedy only through the intensity of her commitment to her art. That her gifts as a painter singled her out from the common roll call of humanity and made her capable of the kind of higher endeavor which ordinary people never even bothered to imagine. When Jane remembered the shuffling, anxious, and groaning patients she nursed at the bath, she suddenly saw them all as pathetic clay, as beings as imperfectly formed as the golem in her hands, even as substances enthralled to a never-altering state of inertia and incompleteness. In magnificent contrast, she perceived her aunt as somebody who understood that surrender to the paltry limitations of the human body and the uninquiring mind was not to be tolerated, that striving was asked of her. These thoughts led Jane, in turn, to look at her own life and dare to ask herself whether her belief in her own singularity, in her innate magnificence, might not be delusional. She knew that she was a clever and patient nurse and that, once in a while, she could seem to bring about relief from pain, which appeared almost miraculous. But was she not working at something thousands of other women could have done? Had her head not been turned by hearing that she was known as the Angel of the Baths? And what in her had justified her disdainful refusal of a man like Valentine Ross? Jane knew that as a doctor he was accomplished and strong, that he'd done no harm in the world, that he was offering her an honest life. Yet she had treated him like a foolish boy, teasing and belittling him. Was this fact alone not proof that where she thought she was marvelous, she was merely haughty and full of pride? And yet, it persisted in her. She knew that it did. This feeling that her life would one day bring her proof that she was exceptional. But how was she to advance towards that proof? Jane looked down at the small figure in her hands, and it came to her that it had been suffering which had refined Emmalina Dean. She herself had been through flames and had found the means to heal herself. Without realizing that she was speaking aloud, Jane whispered, "When or how will any flame engulf me?"
"What did you say, Jane?" asked Emmeline.
"Oh, I was just giving words to what was in my head."
"And what was in your head? It's your mind as well as your body which this portrait is going in search of."
"Yes, I know, dear aunt. And if you find it, please do tell me what I was thinking."
"Naturally, I will. But now you must tell me what you just said aloud."
Jane turned her head for a moment, regarding the low daybed where she'd been told, to her emphatic distaste, Mr. Halton used to lie and practice onanism while watching the young Emmeline's unclothed right arm at work upon a painting. "Well," said Jane, "I was remembering that before I came to London, I refused an offer of marriage."
"Ah," said Emmeline, pausing for a moment with her stick of charcoal in her hand. "Whom did you refuse?"
"He is no one. Or that is how I can't help but see him. He proposed to me in a tea room." A broad smile now lit Emmeline's face.
"A tea room, indeed," she said. "What kind of cake were you eating?"
"I believe it was lemon cake. And at a table, not far distant, there was a small dog which began to howl."
"Ah, so the dog's howling helped you make up your mind to refuse the man?"
"No, I knew I would refuse him. The name of the person is Valentine Ross. I could never marry a man called Valentine, could I, Aunt? There's far too much romantic flummery in the name, isn't there?"
"Romantic flummery? And that, of course, is not to your taste."
"No, it certainly is not. I like things to be stark and plain." Emmeline was silent. She turned back to her work on the portrait. Then she said to Jane,
"What was Valentine's station in life?"
"Oh," said Jane, "he is a doctor who works with my father at Henrietta Street."
"A good doctor?"
"Yes, I think he is very good."
"So I wonder why you see him as no one."
"I suppose I mean that he has no place in my heart."
"Are you certain of this? You know that acceptable offers of marriage do not come along very frequently."
"Yes, I know it. But this one's not acceptable. And anyway, marriage is not on my mind." Emmeline was silent for a moment. Then she said,
"You probably also know that one day, inevitably, it will be."
Chapter 8. The Destiny of the Stomach. Sitting in his dining room one early morning, completing his breakfast of toasted tea cakes and bacon, Sir William Hadean was reflecting on Professor Francois Brousset's conclusions about the normal and the pathological in disease. In particular, Sir William had always been interested in the French physician's challenging idea that very many illnesses are caused uniquely by gastrointestinal inflammations. And as he chewed his bacon, he began to wonder whether, in his daily work, he paid this diagnosis enough attention. Brousset had observed that the destiny of the stomach is always to be irritated. And it was true that very many of Sir William's patients came to Bath primarily to find relief from this discomfort by drinking the pure waters. He treated them also by raising blisters on the skin of the abdomen. When these were punctured, allowing the fluid to run out, it was thought that any infection within the stomach would also be drawn out. And although this treatment was so painful that some patients fainted when the blister was lanced, it was thought on the whole to be effective. Seldom, however, had the doctor inquired about the quality or quantity of the food his clients habitually asked their bodies to ingest. He was inclined to think that they ate too much. Their waistlines bulged and strained against their clothes. Their breath was often foul, indicating a surfeit of fat-laden acids and too much tea. But a physician is not a nursemaid. He can't watch over a man's daily victualling. He has to believe that his patients are not deliberately causing themselves bodily distress by gobbling too many oysters, by drinking claret until their heads begin to spin, or by being unable to tolerate a jam tart unless it's heaped up with Jersey cream. And reason, Sir William, even if I knew this to be the case, what am I to do about it? At this moment in his deliberations, as he was wondering whether he should make greater use of oatmeal poultices in his attempts to ease the perpetual irritation Professor Brousset had identified, his cook, Mrs. Hughes, came into the dining room and approached the doctor's chair, asking if she could have a word before his working day began. "Of course, Mrs. Hughes," said Sir William. "Do please speak to me." The cook was wearing a dirty apron, and she was scrunching this in her work-reddened hands, as if almost to wring it out. And Sir William deduced from this nervous gesture that some anxiety was playing upon her mind. "Is anything the matter?" asked Sir William kindly. "Yes," said Mrs. Hughes. "I'm afraid, sir, that everything is the matter. And that's what I came to tell you, Sir William, that I cannot go on." "Mercy, Mrs. Hughes," said Sir William. "Whatever can you mean?"
"I mean, I cannot do my appointed job in this house anymore, because I'm given no proper orders. How am I to know what you and Dr. Ross wish to take for your lunch if there's no one here to tell me? When Miss Jane was here, she wrote out lists of meals and orders from the fishmongers and the butchers and the greengrocers every 2 days. But the fishmongers just called and asked, 'What is your order? Am I to give you haddock or Dover sole? Winkles for tea, herrings for breakfast?' And I've had to say to him, 'Be gone and take it all away, for I'm not a mind reader.' And the gentlemen care so little, it seems, for my work, that they give me no orders at all. And I cannot continue under these conditions."
Sir William Hadean was a man who invariably had an answer to every question asked, every theory put up for debate. But here, in the face of the angry Mrs. Hughes, he found that he had no idea what to say. Meals in his household, for as long as he could remember, had just appeared at the appropriate moments. He had no memory at all of ever ordering them, except at Christmas, when he liked to be particular about how much rum and brandy and what quantity of orange zest was put into the plum pudding. Otherwise, breakfast, lunch, and supper were just like the weather. They changed from day to day, but they were always just there. By some magic, he had never thought it necessary to learn.
"I am speechless," he stammered.
"Well," said Mrs. Hughes, "I'm afraid speechlessness will not do, sir. As well as fresh produce, we're wanting very many dry goods in the kitchen stalls, upon which Miss Jane always kept a careful eye. But since she's gone, I've been given no money with which to replace them. More than this, Sir William, I've not been paid my own wages for 2 weeks, despite leaving written reminders on your desk. So I'm saying it again, it cannot go on. I've been offered a place at Bramerton Hall by Lady Manners, and I've agreed to take it from tomorrow."
Sir William Hadean looked Mrs. Hughes up and down. Though he had sometimes visited the basement kitchen, primarily to verify it was clean and that no vermin were visible, he had to admit to himself that, if asked to give a detailed description of Mrs. Hughes, he would have found this difficult. He excused himself from this dereliction by remembering that he'd usually seen Mrs. Hughes through a miasma of kitchen vapour, given off by boiling puddings and stewing meat, It was surely just the steam which had made her insubstantial to him, and not his own lack of curiosity about her, wasn't it? And was a busy physician expected to know by heart the features of his own servants? What he saw now was that Mrs. Hughes was a very thin woman, with sinewy arms and grey hair escaping from a dirty cotton cap. That the sustenance of his body had long been in the hands of such a person now surprised him. He would have preferred his cook to be rounded of form, pink of cheek and spotlessly clean. He let escape from him a long and mortified sigh. "If your mind is made up, Mrs. Hughes," he said, "then there is nothing I can do. Only apologize to you for any oversight on my part." But how on earth, he asked himself, when so many strangers were flocking to Bath for the winter season, renting houses and arranging elaborate breakfast parties, matchmaking tea-time feasts and evening soirees, was one to procure a new cook? Because Sir William's dead wife and his daughter had always taken these kinds of domestic question upon themselves and not bothered him with them, he felt like a child presented with some arithmetical sum it did not know how to solve. He sat over the remains of his tea cake and bacon, with coffee going cold in a jug, until Valentine Ross arrived to hold his morning surgery and then shared the problem with him. Ross suggested buying the Bath Chronicle, in the expectation that cooks might advertise their services there. They sent their housemaid Becky out for the paper and looked through it carefully, but this solution did not seem to be accessible within its pages. Many employers were advertising for cooks, but no chefs were offering their services. Sir William said to Ross, "Had we wanted a hod carrier or a coffin maker or a chimney sweep, we would have had no difficulty. But this does not help us at all. Can a hod carrier roast a chicken? Can a sweep confect a caper sauce? I think not." The two men looked at each other, visions of featureless days devoid of any hot food, leading soon enough to unbearable hunger, only to be assuaged at exorbitant daily expense in one of the Bath chop houses, instantly oppressed their minds. And after a moment, Sir William ventured, "I think I will write to Emmeline and ask that Jane returns straight away, and she will find some means to solve this problem for us." He glanced up to see the stricken look on Ross's face, which he was trying to fathom when the doorbell sounded, indicating the arrival of the first patient of the day. Valentine Ross at once left the room to take up his position in his surgery, and no comment was made upon the idea of Jane's return from London. Sir William found himself alone again, his mind in a state of severe puzzlement. Taking matters into his own hands, determined that he should not be subjected to Jane's return to Henrietta Street until he had found some means to cope with the strain and heartache of working at her side, Ross hurried through his roster of patients as quickly as he could that day, and then walked down to Mrs. Morrissey's tea rooms. Here he ordered a pot of tea and a cheese scone, and lingered over this, spreading and re-spreading smaller and smaller quantities of butter on the scone, until Mrs. Morrissey went to put up her closed sign. He then invited her to sit down beside him. He hadn't been to the tea room since the day of his disastrous proposal, and it oppressed him slightly to find himself there, in a place where he had been made to feel so foolish and unhappy. But he had made himself stay, and now he said dramatically to Clorinda Morrissey,
"I shall come at once to the point, Mrs. Morrissey. Sir William and I find ourselves in a difficult position, very difficult indeed, and we feel that you are the only person in Bath who can help us."
Mrs. Morrissey was then told about the severe domestic problem at Henrietta Street and asked if she could see any way out of it. At first she smiled and said modestly, "I'm a relative newcomer to Bath, Dr. Ross, as you know, but of course I can ask around to see whether perhaps one of my clients could lend you a cook."
"Lend? I'm not sure that a borrowed cook is the kind we were hoping for."
"Ah, well, now I do understand that. Perhaps on second thoughts that it's not really a practical idea." Ross finished his tea and said,
"What I was secretly praying is that you could offer us your services for a while, at least as far as providing us with a hot lunch before you open your tea room for the afternoon. I know that Sir William Adeen would be immensely grateful and would pay you whatever you demanded."
"Pay me whatever I demanded? That would be plain foolish, wouldn't it, Doctor? For you know that I am at heart a cake maker. For the rest of everything, I have no skill. All that I could make for you would be meat pies and pasties, and perhaps a steak and kidney suet pudding, or at best an Irish stew with lamb neck and pearl barley as my mother made it. I really have no other ideas when it comes to savouries."
"But you might be willing to make those things, the pies and the stew and so forth, starting tomorrow?"
Starting tomorrow.
Or at worst, the day after. Please, say you will. You could come to Henrietta Street with me now to agree terms with Sir William.
Clorinda Morrissey gestured round her room, where the coal fire was now burned to embers.
Why must you be in such a rush, Dr. Ross? Look at all that I have to clear up now, with only one girl to help me, and never mind that I must begin baking for tomorrow.
I do see that I'm being impatient, but if you won't do it, I'm not sure what we're to do other than starve.
Clorinda Morrissey now measured Ross's blue eyes with her own, which were grey and narrow, and could sometimes close in weary refutation of the very many things in the world which inclined her to anger. In a quiet but firm voice, she said, "You must not use the word starve, Dr. Ross. Not to me. Remember that I come from Ireland. And when I was a young woman in Dublin, what did we endure but the terrible sight of people driven off their lands by hunger and dying in our streets? Did you never hear of the Irish potato famine?"
"I'm sure I did. But I was a child and I had no understanding of it."
"Blight coming to our staple crop and spreading until all the counties of the west of Ireland were laid waste. And the British government, you see, doing nothing. Or almost nothing, only sending a few paltry shiploads of American corn at prices very few could afford. And then putting in a foolish program of public works to give employment to the poor. And what did these works do? They made the destitute people lift turf and sod to fill in empty hollows, to no purpose. They made them work on new roads that led to no destination. It's a wonder it is that Ireland has ever forgiven you."
Ross looked down at his hands. If what he habitually saw in these hands was their strength and their skill, what he now felt was that no part of himself, mind or body, was truly equipped to undertake the complicated demands of human life. There was just too much about the world he didn't understand.
"I am sorry," he said.
He knew that this apology was embarrassingly inadequate to the subject which had suddenly been broached, but these were the only words he was able to find. Luckily for him, Clorinda Morrissey now found herself so contented with her life in Bath that she, no less than Dr. Ross, was disinclined to dwell for long on Ireland's passage through her 4 years of famine, her four circles of hell. She put a gentle hand on his arm and said,
"I apologize for being so harsh.
I will come and talk to Sir William. The beef pies I make have been praised back home, for I do not skimp on the meat."
Chapter 9. Acrobat. No more than half an hour after Mrs. Morrissey returned from agreeing terms with Sir William at Henrietta Street to chivy her young helper Mary into completing the tidying and cleaning of her tea room and to begin on tomorrow's baking, a second caller rang her doorbell. The name of this person was Monsieur Florian Bellinger, and he was a Belgian acrobat. He had met Clorinda Morrissey at one of those autumn galas which had so beguiled her mind when choosing Bath as a destination for her new life. There had been rather fewer of these than she'd hoped, but this one, held in Sydney Gardens, had been splendid. There had been a five-piece orchestra and a wooden dance floor laid on the grass. Suckling pigs had been roasted on two enormous iron spits. On trestles laid out in magnificent numbers, veal pies, pigeon patties, boiled ox tongue, and oysters had been offered, together with jellies, flans, and blancmanges, sluiced down with punch, beer, and lemonade, all for the price of a 3-shilling entry ticket. There had been a maypole for the children, a muzzled dancing bear led round by a Sikh in a jewelled turban, a coconut shy, a gypsy troupe dancing to violins and castanets, and, most popular of all, a team of acrobats, who began by walking around on stilts and ended by flying through the air on a trapeze contraption fastened into the grass with iron hawsers. It had been a cold night, but Clorinda Morrissey, wandering alone among the crowds, had looked up at the stars above the town, heard the yearning of the gypsy violins, and decided that she was, at long last, a rejoicing citizen of the world in all its variety. She congratulated herself on coming to Bath and having the tenacity to realize her small enterprise. She blessed the ruby necklace for giving her the chance to take her place in a cosmopolitan society. When she thought of Ireland on this particular night, it almost seemed to her as though her homeland had floated away out into the Atlantic Ocean, where in its habitual surrender to persecution and suffering, it was now a small, striving speck of green in the vast wash of that swelling and unending sea. It had been while she was engaged in this reverie that Clorinda had turned to see one of the acrobats on stilts coming towards her through the crowds. He was made up in a clownish way, with a red nose and a black mustache, and wearing billowing striped trousers. He seemed to walk without difficulty on his tall stilts, and Clorinda couldn't help but stare at him, wondering what his life could possibly be like if this was his occupation, to perambulate among crowds, 6 feet above them, then to risk his life on the flying trapeze. She asked herself how the human mind arrives at its unexpected decisions and whether they sometimes float up, unnamed and unbidden from the long, shadowy road that is the past. At this moment, the first of the promised fireworks exploded with a mighty boom in the sky and the acrobat fell over. He fell sideways. He landed heavily on the grass, no more than a stilt's length from an organ grinder with a monkey on his shoulder. The monkey screeched and jumped onto the organ grinder's head. People around Clorinda gasped with shock, and yet no one ran to the fallen man, quite as if they believed he was made entirely of wood and couldn't be hurt. But Clorinda Morrissey ran. She knelt by him and put her hand gently on his shoulder. He had just had time to reach out with his arms to prevent himself falling on his head, but he was winded and gasping for breath. Mrs. Morrissey talked to him softly, telling him to lie still. Other people now clustered around. The stilts were pulled from the ridiculous trousers. Children came to gape, then to start playing mock battles with the wooden poles. Clorinda told everybody to move back, to give the poor soul some air. And after some minutes, the acrobat asked Clorinda if she might help him up to his feet. She held his arm tightly. She saw that his false mustache had been torn off in the fall. The following night, this man, Florian Bellanger, who was nearing 50, but with the taut body of youth and a smile of infinite charm, had come round to the tea room, dressed soberly in a black frock coat, bearing the gift of some autumn flowers. In his fractured English, he had told Clorinda Morrissey that he felt great shame.
Shame for what, sir?
Shame to fall.
Oh, said Clorinda. Well, it was all the fault of the fireworks creating such a fright to you. If you ask me, you're one of the bravest people I ever met. To walk on two bits of wood like that, and do that swinging and flying business through the air with no net to catch you. Are you a Roman Catholic, sir? Because I honestly believe Our Lady herself would have been impressed by you, and she would not have you talk of shame.
Florian Bellanger had laughed joyfully and pressed the flowers into Clorinda's arms. They were Michaelmas daisies, and the purple and yellow of them reminded her of the scabious and the ragwort which sprang up in the parks of Dublin for want of a scythe. As she buried her face in them, Florian Bellanger had leaned forward and kissed her ear. After that, he'd called several times. Mrs. Morrissey had made him tea and offered him muffins, for which she did not ask him to pay. If she was working, his eyes followed her about the room. It wasn't difficult to deduce that he had decided to fall in love with her. When she thought about this objectively, her own responses puzzled her. She could see that, by her own standards, in which people of great singularity, even downright oddness, were always favoured over those who were merely replicas of 1,000 directionless others, Florian Bellanger was a perfect man. Foreign, fearless, with an unknown, exotic past, the body of a dancer, and the smile of such sweetness that other women became instantly flustered by it. He was surely an alluring prospect as a lover. And yet Clorinda Morrissey didn't want him. She liked his presence, his voice, his kindness, but she just didn't want him in her bed. After a while, she wondered whether she didn't want him because he had fallen, even as her young carrot-headed suitor in Ireland had fallen and succumbed to death. And she concluded that the only kind of man she might willingly take into her arms was one who would not fall, but on the contrary, be steady enough to lift her up to a higher position in the world. Now, on the day when she'd agreed to help Sir William Adeen and Valentine Ross with their domestic troubles, and was already making lists in her mind of the dishes she might make for them, here was Florian Bellanger at her door once again. Damp and hot from her cleaning of the tea room and the arduous mixing and beating of flour, butter, and sugar, with her brown hair and wild, escaping curls, she was tempted to just signal to him through the glass, telling him to go away. But he was pressing himself very close against the door and holding up a parcel, suggesting that he'd come on an important errand. So Clorinda sent her helper, Mary, into the back kitchen, dried her hands on her apron, and let him in. She saw that his cheeks were pink, as though he'd been running, and there was an agitation in him which she'd never seen before. He held up the parcel. "I bring you this,"
he said. I bring it in hope.
Clorinda took off her apron. The late afternoon, with its visit to Henrietta Street, a house in great need of a good cleaning, she thought, had already been peculiar enough, and what she now longed to do was to lie down on her bed and go fast asleep. Instead, she fell back into one of the tea room chairs and couldn't stop a long sigh escaping from her throat.
Clorinda, said Florian, Clorinda, Clorinda, I say your name in my dreams, but I want more than dreams. It was my gift.
He placed the parcel into Clorinda's hands. It was wrapped in a strip of gauzy fabric and tied neatly with a string.
Open, open, said Florian. It is for the one I love.
This utterance brought to Clorinda's face a look of severity, seldom seen since the opening of the tea rooms had brought her so much gladness. She looked down at the package and knew that, no matter what it contained, she didn't want to unwrap it. I'm sorry, she said. I never accept gifts from gentlemen. Florian Bellanger smiled his seductive smile and said,
Do not say such a disappointing thing, Clorinda. I am not any gentleman. You know that. I am a spirit of the air. So open my gift. Allez, I am sure you will like.
No, said Clorinda. Please, take it back.
I know what you think. That I want something in return, n'est-ce pas? Something you may not wish to give yet? But écoutez-moi bien. You and I, we are not ordinary. We are not bound in chains. We are not slaves to propriety like those English snobs and prigs out there on the street. You, from your green island, me, from far away, we are quite free.
About freedom, I am inclined to agree. We are free if we have the courage to be so. But this also means that I am free to say no to you.
Florian Bellanger now looked as downcast as a trapeze artist whose face has taught itself to smile at perpetual danger ever allows himself to look.
Clorinda, he said,
this is a gift of lace, Croix de Bucelles, from my home. I give it to you as something precious, for friendship, for the hope that you can love me. You sew the lace on your bodice and I, so softly, like the fingers of a flower, I will unlace it to reveal to me what I long to touch.
Clorinda was tired enough on this day to wish to remain sitting in her chair, but she made herself stand up and hand the package back to Bellanger. You are my friend, said Clorinda, but you cannot be my lover. Now you must go, monsieur, I have much work to do. Bellanger took the gift of the Brussels lace and put it sadly into the pocket of his coat.
Tomorrow, he said, I go to Bristol with my trapeze tube. Then to London. I shall be away for some time. But I shall hope, I shall continue to hope that when I return...
Do not, burst out Clorinda. I cannot be doing with it when men are foolish. And to hope that I will change my mind is just pure stupidity. You are a beautiful man, Monsieur Bellanger, but I cannot love you, and that is that.
Florian Bellanger then did a surprising thing. He opened his frock coat and ran a caressing hand down the slim silhouette of his body.
I am beautiful, he whispered. Many women have told me. One lady from Switzerland committed suicide when she could no longer have me as her lover.
At this, Clorinda Morrissey strode to the tea room door and opened it, and a cold winter wind blew in and ruffled the curtains. She said nothing. She told herself that some of the vanities of men are simply not worth commenting on. She stood tall by the door and waited for Florian Bellanger to rebutton his coat and walk out into the darkness.
Chapter 10. And of his kingdom there shall be no end. Only when he had regained a little bodily strength and felt his head clear of the fever that had given him dreams of inescapable terror did Edmund Ross come to the realization that all his collecting equipment was now missing. He counted himself lucky that he still had his wad of money sewn into his hat brim, his handmade boots, and one of his notebooks, but where was his compass? He'd searched every corner of the room he'd been given in Sir Ralph's house, but he did not find it. Gone too were his gun and the boxes housing the corked boards to which he pinned his insects. Also missing were his butterfly nets, his dissecting tools, and his killing jars. He asked Leon, "Do Malay people steal from white people?"
"No, sir, Mr. Ross," said Leon. "Other way round. You come, take our gold, sail away."
"Gold," said Edmund. "There's gold on Borneo."
"There was gold."
"And?"
"I told you. Taken by white people. Nothing left."
After this exchange, Edmund felt that to mention the things he'd lost would make him appear pathetic and puerile. He knew that he would have to reconstruct his boxes, made with such neurotic care in England, search the market stalls of Kuching for a compass and a gun. He would have to purchase jars and chloroform and fabricate new nets. All of this would take time, and from the way Leon looked at him, with unmistakable, long-lashed disdain, he at first began to wonder how far he could trespass on Sir Ralph Savage's hospitality without upsetting the complicated laws of his household. One early morning, Edmund was presented with a white robe, some raffia sandals, and a pair of spectacles. He was led by Sir Ralph to a beautiful, secluded glade in the forest, shaded by palms, where two hammocks had been strung. From the nearby aviary came the cry of the cassowaries, and from out in the forest, the distant shout of the gibbon. The sky above the glade was the colour of opals, shading upwards to a more insistent blue.
"Now you see," said Sir Ralph, "in this very spot right here, one of the commodities that money can buy. It can buy peace. For this to achieve perfection, all I need is the poetry of the King James Bible."
Edmund was told to lie in one of the hammocks and put the spectacles on.
"You may think you don't need them," said Sir Ralph, "but the word of God must be amplified before our eyes, you see? Or else we fail. We are so blind to what is true, only when we see clearly can we begin to understand."
Sir Ralph had opened the Bible at the Gospel according to St. Luke and told Edmund to start reading at chapter 1, verse 26.
"I have chosen the Annunciation," he said, "for what gladdens our hearts more than a new beginning?"
Edmund was tempted to say he'd experienced a troubling new beginning to his life the day he arrived in Borneo. Once he'd entered the forest, tangled in its own impenetrable lore, his perceptions of who and what he was had begun to alter in a way that, in his great hunger for his adventure, he had never predicted. Indeed, there were aspects of himself which he now failed to recognize. He no longer saw a person who walked with a fearless stride, who was master, moment by moment, of his own intent, but felt that he'd become a child again, or else some species of a dream self who could only wander in this green immensity in a state of deep unknowing. 100 times, Edmund had reminded himself that his quest to find and capture rare species of birds and insects had lodged in his heart since he was a boy, and that all he could do was go forward, overcoming terror, and never think of giving up his mission. But yet he knew that something was changed in him. He was somehow lesser than he'd been before. And when at last he'd fallen ill, his sufferings appeared logical to him, inevitable. His illness was the place towards which he'd been traveling all the time. But he told the Rajah none of this. He opened the Bible and turned the filigree pages very slowly until he found St. Luke's Gospel. Wearing the spectacles, Edmund discovered that the words seemed to jump about on the page, now large, now suddenly small, and the sun, falling in ever-changing striations through the palm leaves, decked the verses with a silvery flickering light, so that the reader had the impression that he was trying to recite not from a linen-bound book, but from something obstinately alive. As he began to read, Edmund thought he saw a figure standing very still at the edge of the glade. The figure wasn't hiding. It had just seemed to understand how, among the darkness of the trees, it could be the master of its own ambiguity. When Edmund next looked up, the figure was gone. Had it been there at all? Or had something else, some configuration of shadow and light, confused the watcher? Edmund took off his spectacles and paused in his reading. His gaze interrogated the forest. Nothing moved there. He saw Sir Ralph turn in his hammock and stare at him.
"Why have you stopped?" he asked.
"My mind was just beginning to fill with wonder."
"You must understand, Mr. Ross, that I've been yearning to hear a voice like yours reciting Sir Luke's Gospel to me for more time than you could imagine. Please go on and don't stop until I tell you."
Edmund replaced his spectacles and resumed.
"And the angel said unto her, Fear not, Mary, for thou hast found favour with God. And behold, thou shalt conceive in thy womb and bring forth a son, and shalt call his name Jesus. He shall be great, and shall be called the Son of the Highest, and the Lord God shall give unto him the throne of his father David. And he shall reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there shall be no end."
Edmund kept reading until his throat began to be sore, and the sun, rising higher in the empty sky, cleared the shade of the palms and began to burn down upon him, and he felt the first symptoms of his fever returning.
Malaria, his brother Valentine had warned him, once begun on its first vile visitation, has a habit of returning without any discernible reasons. Watch for this, and when you feel the first signs of fever, lay yourself down to rest.
Edmund closed his eyes, shielding them with the Bible. He wanted to get out of the hammock, but he felt too weak to move. Then he was aware of Sir Ralph at his side, lifting his shoulders gently and placing a kiss on his head.
We shall go on tomorrow, said Sir Ralph. Now you must sleep.
He slept for many hours and woke in the darkness. His head ached, but the fever he thought was about to come back had subsided. He knew that he dreamed about the birds of paradise, about their singular magnificence. The dream had been lit by a multicolored radiance, quite as though sunlight itself was streaming out from the bodies of the birds to fall upon everything around them. What now returned to Edmund Ross was the promise he'd made to himself when he set out on his great adventure, that he would not go back to England without at least one living pair of these birds. He'd been told that the Queen herself yearned to see them and would build some suitable edifice to house them, that they may be seen as marvelous additions to our kingdom. He knew that he was not certain to find them in Borneo. He needed to persuade the owner of a ship to take him further eastwards to the Aru Islands. But what was he now? A man in a strange captivity. A naturalist who'd lost everything he needed to continue his quest. How could his plans ever be realized? Edmund had no idea what time of night it might be. From his window, he could see no moon, only an icy clustering of stars above the palms. He yearned for a light less cold, a candle, and then pen and paper in his hand so that he could write to his brother. Indeed, this is what he longed for, he realized, in a fierce moment which caught at his throat. He wanted Valentine to be by his side, to heal him, to reassure him he could, by some means, embark upon the next bit of his life. Chapter 11. Eyes with Which to See. Finding that he missed his daughter, and his patients complained quite blatantly and loudly about her absence, Sir William Adeen decided to write to Jane, asking her to come back to Bath.
We have been troubled here, he wrote. The nurse who has replaced you has but a quarter of the medical knowledge which you possess. Furthermore, the house does not feel orderly as it always did when you ordered it. The most vexing occurrence is that our once trusted Mrs. Hughes has left us, and Dr. Ross and I have had no luck in engaging another cook. For the time being, and this was Valentine's idea, Mrs. Morrissey from the tea rooms furnishes us with meat pies, kidney puddings, and the like, and places these before us at lunchtime. Becky, who has not left us, but who seems to have adopted a mood of insubordinate indifference towards the household, puts together some kind of cold collation for my solitary suppers. Mrs. Morrissey is exceedingly kind, and your poor father has found himself quite charmed by her and her tales of her life in Ireland, which come pouring into many conversations and seem to imbue them with an unfamiliar colour, which I suppose must be an emerald green kind of hue. I am particularly moved, I cannot say why, by the image of Mrs. M as a barefoot girl, gathering samphire on what she calls the strand at the seashore, with her grandfather who fashioned clothes out of rabbit skins. And I feel I could listen to these stories forever. So strange and compelling does her world seem to me. But she has her business to run, and she tells me that, alas, this arrangement for pies and so forth cannot go beyond Christmas. Then there is something else, Jane. It seems to me that Dr. Ross is in an agitated state, as though he were nursing some great trouble of which I am ignorant. He has taken to going on long, cold morning walks, sometimes arriving here with ice on his beard. On more than one occasion, he has been late for his first patient, and it does appear to me that his work has, in some way, become distressing to him. By late afternoon, he seems very tired and anxious, and instead of staying to take a glass of porter with me or to share my meagre supper, he leaves abruptly to go to his own lodgings. I have the feeling that if you were here, you would intuit what is troubling Valentine and find some means to help him recover his equilibrium. So please, dear Jane, See if you can prise yourself away from London and its delights and from the smell of oils in Emmeline's house and return to us. I would not ask this of you if I did not feel the time to be so out of joint since you left. We must contrive to restore some order to the house. From your loving father, William Adeen.
Compassion towards her father, for his loneliness, for his lack of real understanding of any world outside the world of his profession, had always dictated that Jane Adeen tried never to vex him or hurt